You're listening to Let's Talk Macro,
brought to you by Bandhan Mutual Fund.
Hello and welcome back to Let's Talk Macro. It's that time of the month where we keep you caught up about the macroeconomic status of things. This is a series brought to you by Bandhan Mutual Fund. And I'm Ahalya here, once again joined by Srijit Balasubramanian, economist in the Fixed Income Fund Management team, to talk to you about all of the interesting happenings in both the global and domestic macroeconomic events and landscape. Welcome back, Srijit. How are you?
I'm good, Ahalya. How are you doing?
Doing well. So let's dive straight into it. It's been quite an interesting period for the global economy and markets of late. I feel like I say that every episode, but this is a particularly interesting time because, you know, the August episode, just after the July US payroll data and the Bank of Japan meeting, which had triggered a bit of mayhem across most markets worldwide. And it's been a month since then. And things do seem to have become a bit calmer. But the question is whether the dust is really settled or, you know, whether the markets are in a phase where they're kind of assessing this global economic situation. So why don't we start the episode by looking at how major economies across the world have moved in the last month and what that really means for the market. So the last time we spoke, you know, about growth data getting weaker and what that implies for central banks, how have we moved in that situation and what's the update from last month to now?
So if we look at the U.S., growth indicators have been generally weaker, although there are some exceptions. The main factor here is the labor market, which is loosening towards pre-pandemic levels. Here, we've seen unemployment rate pick up, wage and unit labor cost growth ease, non-farm payroll additions being lower than expected, and unemployment insurance claims have moved up of late. So some part of this is driven by lower demand, but some part is also driven by higher labor supply, mainly due to immigration. Still, overall, the labor market has loosened quite a bit, and the latest data also points to that. So again, job openings in July were down, and that in June was revised lower, in fact. August, non-farm and private sector payroll additions were again below expectations, and unemployment rate wasn't in line, although wage growth ticked up slightly. And if you look at other data also, for example, inflation, July CPI moved below 3% year-on-year. Core inflation and even inflation in non-housing core services, which the Fed tracks closely, has been moderating. We also had weaker manufacturing PMI data, but services are still buoyant and retail sales are also up in July, pretty much suggesting the consumers sort of still holding up. So the data is clearly telling us growth is moderating, but it is not consistent with, say, a recession as of now. The Fed's latest beige book, which aggregates qualitative views of various sources on economic conditions across the country, also sort of suggests this, broader decline in activity, selective hiring, moderating wage growth, easier price pressures from both labor and non-labor inputs, and so on. In a way, this is consistent with the growth impulse from US fiscal policy setting, if you look at it that way, meaning the fiscal deficit is still elevated versus pre-pandemic, that is, with no plans to ease too, but the big jump post-pandemic is done. So fiscal deficit is elevated, but broadly moving sideways is what I mean. Although there is uncertainty in the election outcome and the implication of that on fiscal.
Okay, so interestingly enough, while growth is definitely moderating and it's getting broader, there's nothing yet which points to, say, a recession. And the reason I use the word interesting is because that's kind of been the word on everybody's mind, right? But what does this mean for monetary policy, Srijit? Because, you know, rate expectations in the US had dropped very sharply when we spoke last in early August. So where are we with that situation now?
In the last FOMC meeting, the Fed said it could cut rates at its September meeting, given the further progress on inflation and the Fed's renewed focus on its goal of employment also, apart from inflation. I think we already spoke about this. At the Jackson Hole Symposium last month, the Fed governor made it amply clear by saying the time has come to adjust policy and that the Fed is not looking for further cooling in labor market conditions. So the direction and starting point of rates is very clear. The question that remains is the magnitude and pace of rate cuts, which will be dependent on data, particularly in the labor market. Now, the market pricing of rate cuts this year have gone from around 75 basis points to almost 125 basis points, and that was after the July payroll data release in early August. This is still above 100 basis points now, with three scheduled FOMC meetings left this year. And it is expected to hit a bottom sometime late next year at below 3% now, has actually moved a bit lower. So current expectation, sort of to sum up, is, you know, roughly 100 to 110 basis points of cuts this year, mm-hmm. and another 140 basis points roughly of cuts again next year. But here again, like I said, data, particularly in the labor market, that is going to be really crucial.
So interest rate expectations in the US have moved down in the last month, but is this the same story in Europe as well? You know, we have been exploring all of the different markets around the same time. So why don't we shift our focus to Europe now? Because, you know, in the last podcast, we had also discussed that the first rate cut by the European Central Bank, the ECB, and the Bank of England, BOE, what's kind of happened there ever since our last conversation? And has the expected trajectory really moved down or...
Yeah, so again, inflation in the euro area is moderated, but services inflation, like we discussed last time, continues to be elevated by historical standards, you know, given wage pressures and weak productivity there. At the same time, growth has been quite soft, particularly in manufacturing. We've seen the German GDP in Q2 contract, for example. So for the ECB, it's very clearly growth versus services inflation. But they expect wage growth to moderate further. And profits, which contracted in the first quarter of this calendar year, to continue to absorb some of the wage pressure. So they're not pre-committing to any pace or magnitude of rate cuts, therefore, and are continuing to be data dependent. Mm-hmm. So they've cut once in June and they held rates in July. The broad expectation is they'll cut again this week, in fact, when they're done the meet. But they probably will refrain from providing, you know, any specific or detailed guidance on the rate path, is what the expectation is. But again, if you look at market expectations of rate cuts, US was previously standing out among advanced economies. So the ECB had already cut once. So the recent swing in rate expectations has been therefore more benign for Europe. But that's it. The market now expects slightly above two more rate cuts this year by the ECB and roughly around 100 basis points of cuts again by July next year, somewhere around mid next year, that is.
Okay. And is it the same story with the Bank of England, or are they taking a different approach?
Yeah, so the UK too faces, you know, higher services inflation, although headline inflation is moderated and in fact surprised to the downside a few months ago. Its first rate cut in the cycle was just last month, and even they are not pre-committing to any rate cut paths, and they also want to keep policy restrictive for sufficiently long, like the ECB, given risks of higher inflation, you know, still being there. But they expect inflation persistence and wage pressures to sort of wane over time.
Okay, all right. So the ECB and BOE are on the rate cut path already, but not really pre-committing to anything, which is something we did touch upon in our last conversation as well. But, you know, they're staying data dependent, right? So amidst all of this rate cut talk, I think one of the central banks that really stood out and garnered a lot of attention, and again, a very interesting case, we did talk about it in the last podcast, the Bank of Japan, right? It's quite literally traveling in the opposite direction. After the market turbulence and currency impact, how have things moved there? Can we pick up on that conversation?
Sure. For Japan, the central bank meeting in July, where it hiked rates and provided guidance on further hikes and reduction in government bond purchases, was just before the US FOMC meeting, where the September rate cut was explicitly mentioned, and the US July payroll data, which came in later, was much weaker, and that sort of increased rate cut expectations. The rest is history. So the unwinding of JPY carry trades, stock market, weakness in Japanese yen taking a hit. While things have incrementally sort of settled, the Japanese yen continues to be quite strong versus the US dollar. And in terms of recent data, if you look at, you know, for example, headline and core CPI has been under 3% roughly, mm-hmm. and wage growth has picked up. But the other side is that, you know, growth in real GDP, private consumption, and even industrial production remains quite soft. The central bank is, however, quite upbeat about expectations here as well. So we have to really see how Japanese data alongside, say, what's happening in the US. You know, we'll have to relatively take a look at this, because interest rate differential matters, and the rate of change also matters. But again, keeping all that in mind, for now, the markets are expecting, again, just one hike, let's say 25 basis points hike by mid of next year for Japan.
Okay, I mean, expected interest rate differential is probably the key phrase here that we need to focus on. Keeping it within Asia, I've asked on the podcast series many a time about the economic situation in China. And mostly your answer is always that, you know, despite some kind of policy noise, things have not really materially changed. I think let's touch upon China once again to see if that answer remains the same or if anything has changed.
Yeah, I guess I'll have to give the same answer again.
Yeah.
Nothing is substantially there. You know, inflation has been soft. Growth in aggregate credit, particularly consumer credit, has been weak, pointing to weak demand there. property sector also remains weak, like we've mentioned before. And all of these is reflected in Chinese bond yields, which have been falling despite government efforts to sort of give a flow to it. Mm-hmm. Weak demand in China is helping keep commodity prices benign and, you know, sort of acts as a global deflationary force. But the other aspect to keep in mind is the export of certain products due to both weak domestic demand and excess production capacity in some sectors, causing lower priced Chinese products to hit the global market. So there are two sides to the, you know, low demand, high supply there. But overall, there's not been much of a domestic economic change in China from what we, okay, you know, from when we spoke last year.
Okay, but we've got to persist, so I will be asking you that question as much as I possibly can, and hopefully one day we hear, yes, a different answer. Yeah. So growth is still a concern in China, which can be worrying, but that also brings us to India's recent GDP growth figures, right? This was, I guess, for the second quarter. Are there any surprises there, Srijit, or has everything gone as expected? And what are we looking at in terms of the recent economic context, right?
Yeah, so India's June quarter real GDP grew 6.7% year-on-year after 7.8% in the first quarter. Mm-hmm. And that is in real terms. So in nominal terms, this is just 9.7% after 9.9% in Q1. Real private consumption growth picked up after quite some time to a seven-quarter high, while investment growth also sort of picked up a bit. On the expenditure side, the miss was really government expenditure, which is likely due to the drop during elections in May. Mm-hmm. On the production side, agriculture growth was impacted. So core real GVA growth, that is the, you know, the real growth excluding agriculture and public administration, which sort of reflects private sector demand, the underlying demand more closely, was flat, which is like 7.3% in Q1 and Q2. So it's a pretty buoyant number with healthy internals that we had in Q2. The main aspect one needs to note here is a pickup in private consumption growth after quite some time. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that we really need to keep tabs on is because ground level data has not been really strong for consumption. And sort of therefore, we'll have to keep looking at what sort of this holds for the future. Rural consumption could improve given normal monsoon rainfall and likelihood of a La Nina this year, which augurs well for the following Rabi season also. Mm-hmm. However, urban consumption has been a little soft. So, for example, passenger vehicle sales are not very encouraging. And if you look at the household savings data, and that's also down, we've seen that you know, leverage is quite high there. Some part of this, the high leverage, that is, reflects higher physical savings and drawdown from higher savings built during the pandemic. But total household savings, including financial and physical savings and adjusted for leverage also, have slowed down, you know, from the pre-pandemic levels. Mm-hmm. So this is one area to, you know, to watch out for. The other factor is core inflation, which is sort of looked at often as a barometer of underlying demand in the economy again. And that we know has remained quite soft, mm-hmm, for a while. So these are the two sort of areas to, you know, keep looking at. Separately, if you see some of the other data, you know, bank credit growth is also now easing and sort of has narrowed the gap with deposit growth because the CD ratios were quite elevated before. That's coming off. Mm-hmm. And if you also look at the fiscal impact on growth so far this financial year, it's been soft because central government fiscal deficit is only 17% of the budget estimate so far for this year. This is because of higher than expected RBI surplus transfer in May and also lower spending during elections, which should pick up going ahead. So we should keep a close watch on various growth drivers, given global growth and demand is also likely to get a little softer.
Okay, so a lot of things happening there, lots to analyze and, you know, keep an eye on. But where does that leave us on our expectation of domestic monetary policy, Riddhi Shija? Does it change anything majorly?
We could see a change in RBI's policy stance from withdrawal of accommodation to neutral in October. Mm-hmm. And we also see 75 basis points rate cuts starting December. Now, historically, a change of stance has also happened in the same meeting as the first policy rate change in a cycle. So the encouraging part here for rate action is basically food prices, particularly of vegetables, which had spiked, but sort of are broadly easing now. So some respite there. We also discussed how global growth is softening. That's it. Let's remember the RBI is not really tied to the US Fed's policy. So where current rates are versus long-term neutral rate is different for the two economies. But this is broadly what we expect from the RBI.
Okay, so I think we've quickly, you know, sort of touched upon most of the major economies that we need to be keeping an eye out for. We've reached the part of the podcast where I now try to summarize everything we've learned. Just to quickly summarize what you spoke about in terms of India's context, growth here is buoyant, but we've got to keep a tab on the drivers. And yeah, let's move into today's key takeaways for our listeners. The first would be that growth continuing to clearly slow across major economies. The US now is showing clearer signs, particularly in the labor market, but is not yet flashing red. Europe and China in particular have been slowing down. On the monetary policy front, direction is clear as the US is very likely to join other advanced economy central banks by cutting interest rates this month. The question is really about the pace and magnitude of these rate cuts. In the US, labor market data specifically will come under focus, but broadly speaking, growth inflation dynamics will matter. For example, in Europe, growth is weak, but services inflation is still quite elevated. How rates evolve in the US and Europe will also matter for Japan through interest rate differentials and prospect of carry trade. And finally, in India, growth is buoyant, but it's important to keep an eye on the trajectory of the various growth drivers, particularly private consumption and credit growth. In the near term, food prices are coming off broadly, which augurs well for monetary policy. We expect 75 basis points of rate cuts by the RBI from December, and a change of policy stance to neutral could happen in October, but has historically not been a necessary precondition to rate changes. All good? Was that a good summary?
Yeah, you're spot on with that.
So that ends our podcast today, Srijit. And I think we've also sort of set the tone for our next discussion by mentioning October, right? So I'm looking forward to next month's podcast where we pick up from where we left off today. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. Thank you so much, Srijit, as always, for being our subject matter expert.
Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. We'll be back with another episode of Let's Talk Macro. Until then, bye-bye.
Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all scheme-related documents carefully.